This is Audible.
Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Whoever Fights Monsters, My 20 Years Tracking Serial Killers for the FBI by Robert K. Ressler and Tom Schachtman, narrated by Tom Perkins. Whoever fights monsters should see to it that in the process he does not become a monster, and when you look into an abyss, the abyss also looks into you. Friedrich Nietzsche. Thus spake Zarathustra. 1. The Vampire Killer. Russ Vorpagel was a legend in the Bureau, 6'4 and 260 pounds, a former police homicide detective in Milwaukee who also had a law degree and was an expert in sex crimes and bomb demolition. His job as Sacramento coordinator for the FBI's Behavioral Science Unit took him up and down the West Coast, teaching local police about sex crimes, and he had a lot of credibility to do so, because cops and sheriffs appreciated the depth of his knowledge. On a Monday night, January 23, 1978, that local police confidence had translated into a call to Russ from a small department north of Sacramento. A terrible homicide had been committed, one that was far beyond the ordinary murder in terms of the violence done to the victim. David Wallen, 24, a laundry truck driver, had returned to his modest suburban rented home after work about 6 on the evening of January 23rd and found his 22-year-old, 3 months pregnant wife, Terry, in the bedroom, dead, with her abdomen slashed. He ran screaming to a neighbor's house, and that neighbor called the police. Wallen was so upset that he could not talk to the authorities when they arrived. The first policeman who entered the home, a sheriff's deputy, was similarly shocked. Later, the deputy said that he had nightmares for months from viewing the carnage. As soon as the police had seen it, they called Russ for help, and he called me at the FBI Training Academy at Quantico. Disturbed though I was about the murder, I was also intensely interested, because the case seemed as if it would provide me with an opportunity to use the technique of psychological profiling to catch a killer almost as soon as he had struck. Most of the time when a case was sent to the BSU, the trail was long cold. In Sacramento, it was very hot indeed. Articles in the newspapers the next day reported that Terry Wallen had apparently been attacked by an assailant in the living room of the house as she was preparing to take out the garbage. There were signs of a struggle from the front door to the bedroom. 2 bullet casings had been found. The dead woman was clad in a sweater-type blouse and a pair of pants. Her sweater, bra, and pants had been pulled away from her torso, and her abdomen had been slashed. The officers at the scene told reporters that they could not determine a motive for the death, and that robbery had been dismissed as a motive because nothing had been taken. In fact, the details were far worse than that. But, Russ told me, they were being withheld from the public so as not to cause a panic. Many people often think of the police as rather tough and heartless men who like to shove the public's nose into the dirt so taxpayers will know what the cops themselves have to deal with every day. Not in this instance. Some details were kept in-house to spare the public unneeded agony and fright. There was another reason for withholding information as well, to keep private certain facts that only the killer would know, facts that might later prove valuable in an interrogation of a suspect. What the public was not told then were these details. The major knife wound was a gaping one from chest to umbilicus. Portions of the intestines had been left protruding from it, and several internal organs had been taken out of the body cavity and cut. Some body parts were missing. There were stab wounds to the victim's left breast, and inside those wounds the knife appeared to have been moved about somewhat. Animal feces had been found stuffed into the victim's mouth. There was also evidence that some of the woman's blood had been collected in a yogurt container and drunk. The local police were both horrified and mystified, and Russ Vorpagel was alarmed, too, because from what he knew of sexual homicide, it was clear to him, as it was immediately obvious to me, that we had to act quickly. There was a distinct danger that the killer of Terry Wallen would strike again. The high level of violence, reflected in the ghastly crime scene, made that almost a certainty. Such a killer would not be satisfied with one homicide. An entire string of killings might follow. I was due to go out to the West Coast to teach at one of our road schools on the following Monday, and we made arrangements that would allow me to arrive on the Friday before that, though on the same taxpayer nickel, and help Russ look into this crime. It was going to be the first time that I was able to go on site with a profile, and I looked forward to it. Russ and I were both so convinced of the likelihood of the Slayer striking again, however, that we shot back and forth a bunch of teletypes, and I did a preliminary profile of the probable offender. Criminal profiling was a relatively young science, or art, then, a way of deducing a description of an unknown criminal based on evaluating minute details of the crime scene, the victim, and other evidentiary factors. Here in the original, and not entirely grammatical, notes written at the time, is how I profiled the probable perpetrator of this terrible crime. White male, aged 25 to 27 years, thin, undernourished appearance. Residence will be extremely slovenly and unkempt, and evidence of the crime will be found at the residence. History of mental illness, and will have been involved in use of drugs. Will be a loner who does not associate with either males or females, and will probably spend a great deal of time in his own home where he lives alone. Unemployed. Possibly receives some form of disability money. If residing with anyone, it would be with his parents. However, this is unlikely. No prior military record, high school or college dropout. Probably suffering from one or more forms of paranoid psychosis. I had plenty of reasons for making such a precise description of the probable offender. Though profiling was still in its infancy, we had reviewed enough cases of murder to know that sexual homicide, for that's the category into which this crime fit, even if there was no evidence of a sex act committed at the scene, is usually perpetrated by males, and is usually an intraracial crime, white against white or black against black. The greatest number of sexual killers are white males in their 20s and 30s. This simple fact allows us to eliminate whole segments of the population when first trying to determine what sort of person has perpetrated one of these heinous crimes. Since this was a white residential area, I felt even more certain that the slayer was a white male. Now, I made a guess along a great division line that we in the behavioral sciences unit were beginning to formulate. The distinction between killers who displayed a certain logic in what they had done and those whose mental processes were, by ordinary standards, not apparently logical, organized versus disorganized criminals. Looking at the crime scene photographs and the police reports, it was apparent to me that this was not a crime committed by an organized killer who stalked his victims, was methodical in how he went about his crimes, and took care to avoid leaving clues to his own identity. No. From the appearance of the crime scene, it was obvious to me that we were dealing with a disorganized killer, a person who had a full-blown and serious mental illness. To become as crazy as the man who ripped up the body of Terry Wallen is not something that happens overnight. It takes 8 to 10 years to develop the depth of psychosis that would surface in this apparently senseless killing. Paranoid schizophrenia is usually first manifested in the teenage years. Adding 10 years to an inception of illness age of about 15 would put the slayer in the mid-20s age group. I felt that he wouldn't be much older for two reasons. First, most sexual killers are under the age of 35. Second, if he was older than late 20s, the illness would have been so overwhelming that it would already have resulted in a string of bizarre and unsolved homicides. Nothing as wild as this had been reported anywhere nearby, and the absence of other notable homicides was a clue that this was the first killing for this man, that the killer had probably never taken a human life before. The other details of the probable killer's appearance followed logically from my guess that he was a paranoid schizophrenic, and from my study of psychology. For instance, I thought this person would be thin. I made this guess because I knew of the studies of Dr. Ernest Kretschmer of Germany and Dr. William Sheldon of Columbia University, both dealing with body types. Both men believed there was a high degree of correlation between body type and mental temperament. Kretschmer found that men with slight body builds, asthenics, tended toward introverted forms of schizophrenia. Sheldon's categories were similar, and I thought that on his terms, the killer would be an ectomorph. These body type theories are out of favor with today's psychologists. They're 50 years old and more. But I find, more often than not, that they prove to be correct, at least in terms of being helpful in suggesting the probable body type of a psychopathic serial killer. So that's why I thought this was bound to be a thin and scrawny guy. It was all logical. Introverted schizophrenics don't eat well, don't think in terms of nourishment, and skip meals. They similarly disregard their appearance, not caring at all about cleanliness or neatness. No one would want to live with such a person, so the killer would have to be single. This line of reasoning also allowed me to postulate that his domicile would be a mess, and also to guess that he would not have been in the military, because he would have been too disordered for the military to have accepted him as a recruit in the first place. Similarly, he would not have been able to stay in college, though he might well have completed high school before he disintegrated. This was an introverted individual with problems dating back to his pubescent years. If he had a job at all, it would be a menial one, a janitor perhaps, or someone who picked up papers in a park. He'd be too introverted even to handle the tasks of a delivery man. Most likely, he'd be a recluse living on a disability check. I didn't include some other opinions in the profile, but I did believe that if this slayer had a car, it too would be a wreck, with fast food wrappers in the back, rust throughout, and an appearance similar to what I expected to be found in the home. I also thought it likely that the slayer lived in the area near the victim because he would probably be too disordered to drive somewhere, commit such a stunning crime, and get himself back home. More likely, he had walked to and from the crime scene. My guess was that he had been let out of a psychiatric care facility in the recent past, not much more than a year earlier, and had been building up to this level of violent behavior. Russ took this profile to the several police departments in the area, and they started pounding the pavements looking for suspects. Several dozen policemen rang doorbells, talked to people on telephones, and so on. Media attention on the case was high and focused on two questions. Who had killed this young woman, and, even more puzzling, why? More details continued to surface over the next 48 hours. Sacramento is the capital of California. Terry Wallen had been a state worker on a day off. That Monday morning, she'd cashed a check at a shopping center within walking distance of her home, and there was speculation that the killer had seen her do that and had followed her home. Her mother had called Terry's home at 1:30 in the afternoon and had gotten no answer, and the coroner's office said Terry had been killed prior to that time. The coroner's office also was of the opinion that some of the stab wounds had been inflicted prior to Terry's death, but that fact was not told to the public. The men in charge of the investigation put out the word through the news media that the killer probably had had blood on his shirt as a result of the crime, and asked anyone who had seen a man with blood on his shirt to call a special number. On Thursday, the North Sacramento area was jolted with the news of more grisly murders. At about 12:30 p.m., a neighbor had discovered three bodies in a suburban home that was within a mile of the Wallen murder. Dead were Evelyn Miroff, 36, her 6-year-old son Jason, and Daniel J. Meredith, 52, a family friend. In addition, Miroff's 22-month-old nephew, Michael Ferreira, was missing and presumed to have been abducted by the killer. All the dead had been shot, and Evelyn Miroth had been slashed in a manner similar to Mrs. Wallen. The killer had apparently escaped in Meredith's red station wagon, which was found abandoned not far from the crime scene. Once again, there was no apparent motive for the crime. The house was reported as not having been ransacked. Evelyn Miroth had been the divorced mother of three children. One resided with her former husband, and another child had been at school when the slaying occurred. Sheriff Duane Lowe was quoted by the newspaper as calling the murders "the most bizarre, grotesque, and senseless killings I've seen in 28 years. Murders that had terribly disturbed him. Evelyn Miroth had been a babysitter for the neighborhood, and many of the children and mothers knew her well. Other children had gone to school with the 6-year-old boy. No one could think of any reason for anyone to have killed them. A neighbor who had been friendly with the dead woman told a reporter that she felt like crying, "But I'm scared, too. That's awfully close." Residents of the neighborhood watched the local television news to get what details were available, and then came out of their homes to gather in clusters on the street and discuss the matter. It was a foggy night, and with the waiting patrol cars and emergency vehicles and the knowledge of murder in the air, many found it to be an eerie scene. Though the reports said shots had been fired, no one could be found who had heard any shots. People were frightened. Although police were trying to keep the information about the killings from causing hysteria, enough of it had leaked out so that doors were being double-locked, window shades pulled down. Some people were even loading up their cars, station wagons, and small trucks, and moving out. Russ Vorpagel called me as soon as he heard the news. We were alarmed, of course, but as professionals, we had to put aside our sense of horror and decipher the puzzle right away. From a crime scene analyst's standpoint, the second group of killings provided important new information and verification of what we believed we already knew about the killer. At this second crime scene, again, these are details that were not immediately made public, the man and the boy had been shot but had not been molested. Meredith's car keys and wallet had been taken from him. In contrast, Evelyn Miroth had been even more badly molested than the first female victim. She was found nude on the side of a bed, shot once through the head, and with two crossing cuts on her abdomen, through which loops of her innards partially protruded. Her internal organs had been cut, and there were multiple stab wounds all over her body, including cuts on the face and in the anal area. A rectal swab showed the presence of significant amounts of sperm. In the playpen where the visiting baby was normally kept, a blood-soaked pillow and an expended slug were found. In the bath, there was red-colored water, as well as brain and fecal matter. Blood appeared to have been drunk at this location, too. Also important was that the stolen station wagon had been found not far away, with its door ajar and the keys still in the ignition. The baby had not been found, but the police were fairly certain from the amount of blood in the playpen that he would not be alive. Using this new information, and with a mounting sense of urgency, and the certainty that if not caught this man would kill again, and soon, I refined the profile that I had put together just a few days earlier. The sexual connection of the crimes had become more overt. The number of victims at a single crime scene was growing. The violence was escalating. I was more convinced than ever that the slayer was a seriously mentally disturbed young man who had walked to the crime scene and walked away from the spot where he had abandoned the car. I translated these convictions into a revised profile that indicated the probable offender was single, living alone in a location within 1/2 to 1 mile from the abandoned station wagon. To my mind, the slayer had been so disordered that he had no sense of hiding anything, and had probably parked the station wagon right near his own house. I also reinforced the notions as to his unkempt and disheveled appearance and the slovenliness to be expected at his residence. I also told Russ that I believed that before this man had murdered, he had probably committed fetish burglaries in the area, and that once he was caught, we'd be able to trace his crimes and difficulties back to his childhood. We characterize as fetish burglaries those breaking and entering cases in which the items stolen or misused are articles of women's clothing, rather than jewelry or other items of marketable value. Often, the burglar takes these for autoerotic purposes. With this new profile in hand, more than 65 police personnel hit the streets, concentrating on everything within a half-mile radius of the abandoned station wagon. It was a tremendous manhunt. People in apartments and homes and on the sidewalks were asked whether they had seen a youngish man who appeared quite disheveled and thin. The area of the search was further narrowed when the police received a report that a dog had been shot and disemboweled at a country club close to where the abandoned car had been found. The police found two people who thought they had seen the red station wagon being driven in the neighborhood. But even under hypnosis, these witnesses were able to recall only that it had been driven by a white male. The most promising lead came from a woman in her late 20s who had met a young man whom she had known in high school in the shopping center near the site of the first murder, just an hour or two preceding the attack on Terry Wallen. She had been shocked at her old classmate's appearance, disheveled, cadaverously thin, bloody sweatshirt, yellowed crust around his mouth, sunken eyes. And when he tried to pursue a conversation with her by pulling at the door handle of her car, she had driven away. When the police alerted the area to look for a man with blood on his shirt, she had contacted the authorities. She told the police that the man was Richard Trenton Chase, and that he had graduated from her high school in 1968. By then, it was Saturday. The police learned that Richard Trenton Chase lived less than a block away from the abandoned station wagon, a mile north of the country club, and a mile east of the shopping center. They staked out the area near his apartment and waited for him to come out. At this point, he was only one among a half dozen likely suspects. He did not answer phone calls to the apartment, and toward late afternoon, the watchers decided they would try a ruse to see whether they could lure him outside. They knew that the killer had a .22 revolver and was not afraid to take a human life, so they proceeded carefully. One went to the apartment of the manager of the project as if to use the telephone, while the other openly walked away from the front of Chase's apartment. Moments later, Chase appeared at the door with a box under his arm and started to make a run for his truck. As soon as he began to run, the officers knew they had their man, and they ran to grapple with him. As they rolled about, the .22 came out of his shoulder holster. In their grasp, he tried to hide what was in his back pocket, Daniel Meredith's wallet. The box he carried was full of bloody rags. Chase's truck was near the apartment, and it was a dozen years old, in poor condition, and littered with old newspapers, beer cans, milk cartons, and rags. A locked toolbox and a 12-inch butcher's knife were also in the truck, together with rubber boots with what appeared to be blood on them. In his apartment, as slovenly as could be, were some animal collars, three food blenders with blood in them, as well as newspaper articles about the first murder. Dirty clothing was strewn about the house, some with blood on it. Several dishes in the refrigerator had body parts in them, and a container held human brain tissue. In a kitchen drawer, there were several knives that turned out to have been taken from the Wallen residence. A calendar on the wall of the apartment had the inscription, "Today, on the end of January dates of the Wallen and Mirith Meredith murders." The same inscription was on 44 more days spread out over the remainder of 1978. Would there have been 44 more murders? Thankfully, we'll never know. The police were tremendously relieved that the murderer had been caught, for there could be no real doubt that this was the slayer, from the evidence he carried and the descriptions that he matched. Everyone was grateful to the FBI and very appreciative of the profile, and some people later said that the profile caught the killer. That, of course, was not true. It's never true. Profiles don't catch killers. Cops on the beat do, often through dogged persistence and with the help of ordinary citizens, and certainly with the aid of a little bit of luck. My profile was an investigative tool, one that in this instance markedly narrowed the search for a dangerous killer. Did my work help catch Chase? You bet, and I'm proud of it. Did I catch him myself? No. The fact that Chase so precisely fit the profile that I had drawn up in conjunction with Russ Vorpagel was gratifying to me on two counts. First and foremost, because it helped in the apprehension of a violent killer who would undoubtedly have continued his homicides if not caught immediately. Second, because when the murderer matched the profile, that gave us at the BSU more information on how to evaluate subsequent crime scenes and identify the characteristic signs that murderers leave behind. In short, it helped us to refine further the art, and I do mean the art because it had not yet approached the status of being a science, of profiling. In the days and months after Chase's apprehension, I closely followed the information coming to light about this strange young man. Almost immediately after his arrest, he was connected to an unsolved murder that had taken place in December, not far from the site of the two other events. It turned out that I had been wrong about Terry Wallen being the first victim. She was actually the second. A Mr. Ambrose Griffin and his wife had returned home from the supermarket on December 28, 1977, and were taking groceries into their house from their car. Chase had driven by in his truck and had fired two shots. One hit Griffin in the chest and killed him. Ballistic research on Chase's .22 caliber gun, taken from him after the other two murders, showed that it had also discharged the bullet that killed Griffin. Chase also fit the description of the unknown assailant responsible for some earlier fetish burglaries in the neighborhood, and was pinpointed as the probable abductor of many dogs and cats. Several dog collars and leashes found in his apartment matched up with those taken from missing dogs and puppies from the surrounding area. These dogs and cats were most likely killed for his strange purposes. He may even have drunk their blood, though we could never be certain of that. Computer searches also came up with an incident in mid-1977 in the Lake Tahoe area, when an Indian agent on a reservation stopped and arrested a man whose clothes were soaked with blood and whose truck had guns in it, as well as a bucket of blood. It was Chase. He had gotten off that time because the blood was bovine. He had paid a fine and explained away the blood on his clothes by saying that he'd been hunting rabbits that had bled on his shirt. As reporters and court officers interviewed people who had known Chase and unearthed records about him, the whole sorry history emerged. Born in 1950, Chase was the male child of a moderate-income family, thought of as a sweet and cooperative son. At age 8, he was a bedwetter, but this behavior soon ceased. His problems really seemed to have begun at age 12 or so, at the time when his parents began to fight at home. His mother accused his father of infidelity, of poisoning her, and of using drugs. The father, when interviewed, said that these accusations and other loud arguments had to have been overheard by Chase. A later evaluation by a group of psychologists and psychiatrists who interviewed the family labeled Mrs. Chase as the classic mother of a schizophrenic. Highly aggressive, hostile, provocative. The arguments between father and mother continued for nearly 10 years, after which the couple was divorced and the father remarried. Chase was of just about normal intelligence, IQ around 95, and an ordinary student in high school in the mid-1960s. He had girlfriends, but his relationships with them were broken off when they got to the point that he attempted intercourse, but was unable to sustain an erection. He had no close friends, no long-standing relationships with anyone but his family. Psychiatrists and psychologists who examined him later were of the opinion that Chase's mental condition began to deteriorate in his second year of high school, when he became rebellious and defiant, had no ambition, and his room was always in a state of disarray. He was smoking marijuana and drinking heavily. One of the girlfriends who had been close to him said that he started hanging out with the acid head crowd. He was arrested in 1965 for possession of marijuana and was sentenced to community cleanup work. As these sort of details were published in the newspapers, reporters and many in the public saw evidence for attributing Chase's murders to the influence of drugs. I disagreed. Although drugs may have contributed to Chase's slide into serious mental illness, they were not a real factor in the murders. We have found that drugs, while present in many cases, are seldom the precipitating factor in serial murders. The true causes lie much deeper and are more complex. Despite his deterioration, Chase managed to graduate from high school and held a job for several months in 1969. It was the only job that he ever managed to keep for more than a day or two. He attended a junior college but could not keep up with the work or, friends remembered, with the social pressures of college life. In 1972, he was arrested in Utah for drunk driving. This seemed to have hit him hard, for after it, he later recalled, he had stopped drinking altogether. But he was on a downward curve. In 1973, he was picked up for carrying a gun without a license and resisting arrest. He had been at an apartment where a party of young people was in full swing and had attempted to grab a girl's breast. He'd been ejected from the party, and when he returned, the men jumped him and held him for the police. As they did so, a .22 pistol fell from his waistband. Charges were reduced to a misdemeanor. He paid a $50 fine and walked away. He couldn't hold a job and went between his father's and mother's homes and was supported by them. In 1976, after Chase tried to inject rabbit's blood into his veins, he was sent to a nursing home. Conservators were appointed by the court to take charge of his affairs, thereby relieving his parents of that responsibility. Taking care of Chase was getting beyond the capabilities of any individuals even then. Conservatorship is also a way of having the state pick up the tab for caring for a mentally disturbed person. Paying the bills privately can otherwise bankrupt any but the very wealthiest families. On the grounds of the nursing home, according to some of the nurses later interviewed, Chase was a frightening patient. He bit the heads off birds he had captured in the bushes and was several times found with blood on his face and shirt. In a diary, he described the killing of small animals and the taste of blood. Two nurses' aides quit because of his presence at the institution. He became known among the staff as Dracula. All of his bizarre actions had a reason, at least in Chase's own mind. He believed he was being poisoned, that his own blood was turning to powder, and that he needed this other blood to replenish his own and to stave off death. A male nurse was directed by the staff physicians to put Chase into a room at night with one other patient, and he refused to do so, fearing that if something happened, a distinct possibility according to the nurse, he would lose his license. Medication seemed to control Chase to the point of stability, and a psychiatrist wanted to release him for outpatient care to make room for more seriously ill patients. The male nurse later recalled, "When we learned Chase was going to be released, we all raised hell about it, but it didn't do any good." An outside physician later asked for his opinion about what had happened to allow Chase to be released, thought it had probably come about because his medication was controlling him. The families of the victims in the Chase murders later sued the psychiatrists who had allowed Chase out of the institution, asking for considerable damages. Chase was released in 1977, mostly in the care of his mother, who obtained an apartment for him, the one at which he was eventually captured. He spent some time with her, but most of the time he was alone at the apartment. Chase was an outpatient who subsisted on a disability check and bragged to people who knew him about not having to work. Some of the bills at the apartment were paid by his father, who also tried to spend time with his son, taking him on trips for weekends, buying him presents. Old acquaintances who bumped into him during this period after his release said he seemed to dwell entirely in the past, to talk of events that had occurred when they were in high school as if they were current, and not to say anything about the intervening 8 or 10 years. He did, however, speak of flying saucers, UFOs, and of a Nazi Party crime syndicate that he thought had been operating in high school and was still after him. When his mother complained about the disarray at his apartment, he barred her from entering it. When his father went to rescue him after the incident near Lake Tahoe, Chase dismissed it as an accident and a misunderstanding by the local police agents of a hunting mishap. That Lake Tahoe incident was in August of 1977. Chase's actions from then until the first discovered murder provide such a clear picture of a deteriorating mind and an escalating series of criminal behaviors that we need to paint them in some detail. In September, after an argument with his mother, Chase killed her cat. Twice in October, he bought dogs from the ASPCA for about $15 each. On October 20th, he stole $2 worth of gasoline for his truck. When an officer questioned him about it, he was calm and denied the charge and was allowed to drive away. In mid-November, he answered an ad in the local paper for Labrador pups, showed up at the owner's home, and bargained successfully to take two home for the price of one. Later in November, he made a phone call to torment a family whose dog he had taken on the street, and who had placed an ad in the paper asking whether anyone had seen it. Police received reports of other animals missing in the neighborhood. On December 7th, Chase went to a gun shop and purchased the .22 revolver. He had to fill out a form that required him to answer whether or not he had ever been a patient in a mental institution, and he swore that he had not. There was a waiting period, and he would not be able to pick up the gun until December 18th. During the intervening days, he did some work on re-registering his truck and other tasks that required a coherent mind. He kept articles from the newspapers about a Los Angeles strangler and circled advertisements for free dogs. His father took him to a store to pick out a Christmas present, and Chase accepted an orange parka, which he wore steadily from the moment he obtained it. After picking up the gun from the store on December 18th and buying several boxes of ammunition for it, he began to shoot. First, he fired one shot at a windowless wall of the residence of a family named Fairs. A day or so later, he fired through the kitchen window of the house of the Polensky family, parting the hair of Mrs. Polensky, who stood bent over the kitchen sink. One shot was fired. Shortly thereafter, Chase fired the two shots at Ambrose Griffin, one of which killed him. The Griffin home was located across the street from the Fairs house. The shots at Mrs. Polensky and Griffin were hardly random. Later analyses showed that from a traveling car, one would have had to fire carefully to avoid hitting the many trees on the Griffin block, and to hit the man in the chest. Mrs. Polensky was extremely lucky to be alive. On January 5, 1978, Chase bought a copy of the Sacramento Bee, which had an editorial about the Griffin killing. He kept this page, with its societal condemnation of the senseless shooting. On January 10th, he bought three more boxes of ammunition. On January 16th, he set a fire in a garage in order to drive out of the neighborhood some people whose playing of loud music had annoyed him. On January 23rd, the day he killed Terry Wallen, the police were able to trace Chase's actions moment by moment. Early in the day, he attempted to enter a home in the neighborhood, but he left after coming face to face with the woman occupant at the kitchen window. He then sat on her patio, motionless for some time. She called the police, but he left before the authorities could arrive. Not too many minutes later, a homeowner caught him in the act of having illegally entered another residence. He fled, and the man ran after him down the street, lost him, and then went back to assess the damage. Chase had taken some valuable objects, defecated on a child's bed, and urinated on clothing in a drawer. The latter behaviors were signs of classic fetish burglaries. An hour later, Chase was in the parking lot of the shopping center where he met the woman he recognized from high school and who became suspicious of him. He was wearing a blood-stained shirt, had a yellow crust around his mouth, and was shockingly different from the boy she had known years ago. She didn't recognize him until he asked her whether she had been on the motorcycle when her former boyfriend, a friend of Chase's, had been killed. She said no and asked him who he was. He told her his name. She tried to edge away and said she had to go to the bank. He waited for her, then followed her to her car and attempted to get in on the passenger side. She locked it and sped away. Minutes later, he walked across the porch of a home near the shopping center, and when the owner called out to him not to do that, he said he was just taking a shortcut. Then he left those premises and entered the almost adjoining home of Terry Wallen. By mid-1978, the body of the missing child had been found, also not far from Chase's last residence. In prison, he had refused to do much talking. The trial site was moved from Sacramento to Palo Alto, and there were other delays. During the next year, one psychiatrist did manage to gain Chase's confidence enough to have conversations with him, and in one of these elicited the following rather remarkable confessional statement in response to a question about whether Chase would have continued with his killings.
"The first person I killed was sort of an accident. My car was broken down. I wanted to leave, but I had no transmission. I had to get an apartment. Mother wouldn't let me in at Christmas. Always before, she'd let me come in at Christmas, have dinner, and talk to her, my grandmother and my sister. That year, she wouldn't let me in, and I shot from the car and killed somebody. The second time, the people had made a lot of money, and I was jealous. I was being watched, and I shot this lady. Got some blood out of it. I went to another house. Walked in, a whole family was there. I shot the whole family. Somebody saw me there. I saw this girl. She had called the police, and they had been unable to locate me. Kurt Silva's girlfriend. He was killed in a motorcycle accident, as a couple of my friends were, and I had this idea that he was killed through the syndicate, that he was in the mafia, selling drugs. His girlfriend remembered about Kurt. I was trying to get information. She said she was married to somebody else and wouldn't talk to me. The whole syndicate was making money by having my mom poison me. I know who they are, and I think it can be brought out in a court of law if I can pull the pieces together like I've been hoping." The trial began in early 1979, and on May 6, 1979, Sacramento Bee reporter Iris Yang described Chase in the courtroom. "The defendant has a totally lusterless quality. Dull, limp brown hair, sunken opaque eyes, a sallow complexion, and scarcely a spare ounce of flesh clinging to his bony frame. For the past 4.5 months, Richard Trenton Chase, just a couple of weeks short of his 29th birthday, has sat hunched in his chair, toying with papers in front of him or staring vacantly at the fluorescent lights of the courtroom. There was a trial only because the prosecution vigorously sought the death penalty under a recently enacted California state law. The defense had wanted to say that Chase was mentally ill and incompetent to stand trial, but the prosecution had argued that Chase had had enough knowing shrewdness at the time of his crimes to be deemed responsible for his actions and that he must be held accountable for them. He was charged with 6 counts of first-degree murder: Terry Wallen, the 3 people at the Miroth home, the dead baby, and Ambrose Griffin. The jury deliberated only a few hours before pronouncing him guilty on all counts. The judge sent him to death row at San Quentin to await the electric chair. I did not agree with this verdict or with the disposition of the case. It occurred in the same time frame as the murders of Mayor Moscone and Supervisor Harvey Milk by former San Francisco City Hall Supervisor Dan White. White claimed he had been made insane by such things as eating the junk food Twinkies, and his diminished capacity defense was accepted, and he was sent to a state prison and not given the death penalty. Richard Chase, who was clearly mentally ill and who should have spent the rest of his life in a mental institution, was sentenced to death. While Chase was on death row at San Quentin in 1979, John Conway and I visited him. Conway was the FBI's prison liaison man in California, an exceptionally smooth, good-looking, and polished guy who had a knack for getting inmates quickly into a conversational mood. Going to see Chase was one of the strangest experiences I have ever had. From the moment I entered the prison to the moment I sat down in the room where we would conduct the interview, it was a series of doors slamming behind us, an oppressive and frightening experience. I'd been in many prisons before, but this was the most grisly. I felt I was going beyond a point of no return. Conway was much more nonchalant about it than I. We went up through several elevators, and the final one disgorged us on death row. I heard weird noises, groans, and other almost inhuman sounds coming from the cells. We sat in a room awaiting Chase and heard him coming down the hall. He was in leg irons and clanked as he walked, and I thought immediately of Marley's ghost in Dickens's A Christmas Carol. In addition to the leg irons, he was handcuffed and had one of those security belts with a loop through which the handcuffs were attached. He could do nothing but barely shuffle along. His appearance was another shock. Here was this skinny, odd-looking young man with long black hair. But it was his eyes that really got me. I'll never forget them. They were like those of the shark in the movie Jaws. No pupils, just black spots. These were evil eyes that stayed with me long after the interview. I almost got the impression that he couldn't really see me, that he was seeing through me, just staring. He showed no signs of being aggressive and simply sat passive. He carried in his hands a plastic cup, which he didn't talk about at first. Since he had already been convicted and was on death row, I didn't have to go through the sort of romancing that usually characterizes my first interview with a murderer. Ordinarily, I have to work hard to show the interviewee that I am worthy of his trust and that he can talk easily with me. Chase and I talked with relative ease, considering his mental state. He admitted his murders, but said he had done them in order to preserve his own life. He told me that he was fashioning an appeal, and that it would be based on the notion that he had been dying and had taken lives in order to obtain the blood he needed to live. The threat to his life was soap dish poisoning. When I told him that I wasn't aware of the nature of soap dish poisoning, he enlightened me. "Everyone has a soap dish," he said. "If you lift up the soap and the part underneath the soap is dry, you're all right. But if it's gooey, that means you have soap dish poisoning." I asked him what the poison did to him, and he responded that it turns one's blood to powder, essentially pulverizes the blood. The powder then eats at one's body and energies and reduces one's capacities. Listeners may find Chase's explanation laughable or impossibly weird. In this situation, when I was confronted with it, however, I had to react properly. I could not appear appalled or shocked, and had to take the explanation for what it was worth, an illustration of the reasoning of a murderer. The rule is you stay out of commenting on the fantasy, and by your comments urge him to continue. So I couldn't say about soap dish poisoning, "There isn't any such thing," because that wouldn't have helped. Neither could I say, "Oh yes, I know people who've had soap dish poisoning." I merely accepted his explanation and didn't debate him about it. The same principle applied when he began to tell me that he had been born Jewish. I knew that to be untrue, and that he had been persecuted all his life by the Nazis because he had a Star of David on his forehead, which he proceeded to show me. To this announcement, I could have said, "That's baloney," or gone in the other direction and answered, "Gee, what a beauty, I wish I had one like it." Neither answer would have helped much in the conversation. I saw no Star of David, but I thought his mention of it might be a trap that Chase was setting for me, or a test of how far I was willing to go along with his explanation. He might be tricking me, telling me it was on his forehead when it was really on his arm or his chest, and he wanted to see how much I knew about him. In this instance, I merely told Chase that I hadn't brought my glasses along, and that the lighting was dim and I couldn't see the birthmark, but that I accepted his word that it was there. He said that the Nazis had been connected to the UFOs that constantly hover over the earth, and that had commanded him by telepathy to kill in order to replenish his blood. He summed up his explanation by saying to me, "So you see, Mr. Ressler, you see very clearly that the killings were in self-defense." Perhaps the most important information that I obtained from this interview came from a question as to how Chase had chosen his particular victims. It was a point that had eluded many other of Chase's interviewers, but I had gained his confidence enough that he was comfortable telling me. He had been hearing voices that told him to take a life, and he just went down the street rattling doors. If a door was locked, he wouldn't go in. If it was open, however, he went in. I asked him why he hadn't simply broken down a door if he wanted to go inside. "Oh," he said, "if the door is locked, that means you're not welcome." How slim the line between those who escaped being the victims of a heinous crime and those who died awful deaths at the hands of Chase. At last I asked him about the little cup that he carried. He said it was evidence that the prison was attempting to poison him. He shoved it forward, and it contained some gooey yellow mess that I later identified as the remains of a packaged macaroni and cheese dinner. He wanted me to take it and have the FBI lab at Quantico analyze it for him. It was a gift I felt I could not refuse. The information I gleaned from this interview was helpful in verifying the portrait we at the BSU were already putting together of the disorganized killer, a portrait that is in sharp contrast to that of the organized killer. Chase not only fit the disorganized pattern, he embodied it more than any other individual that I or others in law enforcement had encountered. In that regard, his was a classic case. While at San Quentin, the other inmates taunted Chase. They threatened that if he came near enough, they'd kill him, and told him he ought to commit suicide. Prison psychologists and psychiatrists who examined Chase in those days waited for the brouhaha over the death penalty to calm down, and then suggested that since Chase was psychotic, insane, and incompetent, and chronically so, he ought to be transferred to the prison at Vacaville, California, known as the California Medical Facility of the prison system, the place that houses the criminally insane. I certainly concurred in that judgment. By this time, and following up on the notion that the FBI was going to analyze what the prison was feeding him, Chase was writing letters to Conway and to me, conveying to us that he needed to come to Washington, D.C. to perfect his appeal. He was certain that the FBI would want to know that the UFOs were now connected to airplane crashes and to anti-aircraft weapons of the sort that were being used against the United States by the Iranians. "The FBI could easily detect the UFOs by radar," he wrote to me, "and find they follow me and are stars in the sky at night that light up through some type of controlled fusion reaction machines." That was the last I heard from Chase. Just after Christmas in 1980, Chase was found dead in his cell at Vacaville. He had saved up many antidepressant pills that had been given to him to damp down his hallucinations and make him a tractable prisoner, and had taken them all at once. Some called his death suicide. Others continued to believe that it was accidental, and that Richard Trenton Chase had taken all those pills in an effort to quiet the voices that had driven him to murder, and that continued to torment him until he died. 2. Whoever fights monsters. There was a monster on the loose in Chicago, and I was intrigued. It was 1946, and I was all of 9 years old. My dad worked in security and maintenance for the Chicago Tribune, so we always had the newspaper around the house. In the Tribune the summer before, I had read about the killing of a middle-aged married woman in an apartment building. It was just an isolated case until the following December, when an ex-wave was killed in an apartment hotel. The killer had written on a wall, in the woman's lipstick, "For heaven's sake, catch me before I kill more. I cannot control myself." from evidence that was too awful to print in the newspaper, and at which I could not even guess, the police thought the killings of the two women might be connected. The Tribune was in the thick of the chase for the killer, sending reporters here and there in search of clues. Shortly after the turn of the year, there was another crime that at first was not thought to be connected to the other two. A 6-year-old girl, Suzanne Degnan, was taken from her room in her house and killed. Her body was found scattered in parts in the sewers in the Chicago-Evanston area. All of Chicago was aghast at this grisly murder. Many parents were worried for the safety of their children. I wondered, what kind of person would kill and cut up a little girl? A monster? A human being? As a 9-year-old boy, I couldn't imagine what sort of person would commit such a heinous crime, but I could fantasize about catching Suzanne's killer. I suppose I was somewhat afraid, and the fantasy was my way of coping with that fear, but I think I was actually more fascinated than afraid. At the movie houses on Saturdays, I had seen a model I wanted to reproduce. Either in Our Gang or The Little Rascals, by now I've forgotten which, there was a detective agency. In the summer of 1946, I formed one with 3 of my friends. The RKPK agency had an office in a garage and a war wagon, a wooden structure on wheels that we called the RKPK Express. When we weren't conducting an investigation, we'd use the express to haul groceries, a quarter a delivery. That delivery business was only a subsidiary that we kept going in order to meet our overhead costs. Like most fictional movie detectives, we weren't getting enough cases to pay the rent. Our main activity that summer of 46 was to put on detective clothes, hats and long coats, and to lurk around the bus stop waiting for a suspect to trail. We were trying to look like FBI men, who were heroes to the country back then, or maybe like Sam Spade. When one of the fathers or elder brothers in the neighborhood would get off the bus with his lunch pail or briefcase, we'd assume that this was a suspect in the killing of Suzanne Degnan and follow him home, then stake out positions around his house until it was time to change shifts and compare notes. The men would wonder what these goofy kids dressed up in long coats were doing. They never did figure it out. William Herons was caught that summer, and I found it amazing that he had killed the little girl as well as the two women in the apartments. The reason he gave was that they had surprised him in the course of committing burglaries that were described as sexual in nature. According to the mores of the time, no further details were given, and since I didn't know very much about sex at age 9, I shrugged off that part of the description. Years later, I would learn far more than the average person gets to know about what were, in effect, fetish burglaries. At the time, the most intriguing fact about Herons to me was that he wasn't that much older than I, just 17, a student at the University of Chicago. It later turned out that he had been sane enough after each murderous event to go back to his dormitory room and act calmly enough to avoid detection. His arrest came almost as an accident when an off-duty policeman was called to stop Herons as he was trying to make a getaway after an unsuccessful burglary. There was quite a scuffle, and the policeman had been extremely fortunate that Herons's gun misfired twice before another officer arrived and was able to smash Herons's skull with a handy flower pot. In his dormitory room, the authorities found souvenirs from his fetish burglaries. Time magazine called the Herons case the crime story of the century and marveled at how many reporters flocked to Chicago from all over the country to learn about it and to observe the trial. Once Herons had been caught, we 9-year-olds watched the bus stop, waiting for Herons the dangerous killer, and we played that we were following him to his lair. The fantasy game and our detective agency faded that summer, but in a way I continued even at that age to follow and be fascinated by Herons himself and many criminals like him and, as I grew up, to fall naturally into what became an important part of my life's work, catching and understanding criminals. An average student in high school, I wasn't particularly interested in any one subject, and that attitude carried over into 2 years of ho-hum attendance at a community college in Chicago. Then I joined the Army, got married, and was sent to Okinawa. While overseas, I still received the Chicago Tribune, and in one Sunday supplement read about a school of criminology and police administration at Michigan State. It sounded good. I applied, was accepted,